I wanted to begin. I studied at Iowa in 2002 to 2004, and Hood and I were talking about this on the way down in the car. There, my fellow students, you know, very educated, very worldly, highly literate, had read no Latin American authors outside of García Márquez. In fact, I even had one good friend, brilliant writer, brilliant prose stylist, hyper literate guy who told me that he preferred not to read in translation at all because he was such a kind of a prose snob that he didn't want to lose anything. He really was and is a kind of poet of language, even though he writes stories and nonfiction, has exquisite sentences, the kind of sentences you read again and again in English, and you really derive a great deal of pleasure from them. But so his justification for not reading things in translation was, well, I only want to read the best prose style that I can possibly expose myself to. So the level of ignorance was astounding. I mean, people had heard of Borges, you know, but they mostly hadn't read him. They might have read Calvino, which is like, you know, reading the son but not the father. They'd heard of García Márquez perhaps, but they hadn't read him, certainly. Juan Rulfo, no one had ever heard of him. To say nothing of Brazilian writers, lots of other people who were sort of not well known or even known, I should say. So this was a great surprise for me. I did not study Latin American literature. I did not study literature. In fact, I studied anthropology. I read in a kind of scattershot way that a lot of undergrads read, or a lot of people who like to read without really knowing what they're reading. So just I wouldn't consider myself learned in any respect regarding any aspect of any kind of literature. But I mean, at least I'd heard of these writers, you know, at least at the very least I knew the conversation. Now, to be fair, and just to give you a level of like what I'm talking about, I got to Iowa and I'd never heard of John Cheever. And at Iowa, everyone carries around John Cheever like it was the little Bible. And I love John Cheever now, but I actually had never heard of him. And, you know, he's a classic American chronicler of you know, the travails of the New York suburbs and the upper middle class and alcoholism and, you know, cheating on your wife with a man and, you know, all kinds of great stuff. A wonderful, wonderful writer. At the time, he just had escaped my worldview somehow. There was definitely an education that I had in terms of kind of, I guess, contemporary American canonical short story writing, which is what they shoved down your throat at Iowa. I hope at least that I got some friends of mine to start reading writers that I thought were important. But it was troubling because I think with good reason, a lot of my colleagues had sort of read some García Márquez and then been exposed to one or two of the unfortunate facsimiles that are out there, and so had sort of made a generalization. Well, you know, like, why would I read another? Why would I try something else if it's just going to be, you know, it's going to be more parrots and butterflies and palm trees and stuff? And there's a few really reprehensible pieces of writing that have been published and have sold millions of copies. There's a writer named Luis de Berniers, who's most famous for Corelli's Mandolin, but who wrote a series of three awful books that copy García Márquez in a really terrible, brazen way, and just makes it a caricature, you know. And I remember a friend of mine pushing this on me. Oh, you're Latin American, you'll love this. He's a British guy, and there's a cat that keeps growing, and there's like a 100-year-old man who's still very virile, and there's all this really, really terrible stuff, and I just got really angry, and I haven't talked to my friend in a while. But he said he liked the stories. He thought it was a very inventive stories, and perhaps that's true. But stylistically, it was so derivative you know, as to be offensive, I would say. So I could understand where some of my friends were coming from. It's like, well, if this is what you think Latin American literature is, and you've sort of read the major works of García Márquez, and, you know, you're over it, then you know, I would probably prefer to read Marilynne Robinson also. But there are other writers, and I think one of the exciting things that has happened in recent times, in the last few years, is Roberto Bolaño becoming well-known here in the United States. Has sort of opened the door for more and greater examination of contemporary Latin American letters. I think that's certainly a positive thing, and certainly we were overdue for kind of a revised look at what's happening in Spanish, in the Spanish language, in Latin America specifically. I want to talk a little bit about my own role. Paulo, you had a great phrase of the problem of Latin America and the U.S. imaginary. In my role, both as a writer for Etiqueta and both as a writer of fiction, I sometimes feel like I have the opposite problem, that I the problem of the U.S. and the Latin American imaginary. So that I'm often called upon to interpret the U.S. for Peruvians, and vice versa. You know, and the opposite is certainly, like, at times very comic. When my first book came out, I got a lot of emails saying, you know, I really loved your book. Can you recommend a hotel in Cusco? It was really great sort of role, and I just kept wondering that, you know, does Philip Roth get that question about New Jersey? Like, I don't think so, you know. And it's true that I'm sure I've sold a lot, you know, to the extent that I've sold a lot of books, I've sold many books to you know, people who go backpacking in Peru, you know, and it's like my book is recommended in the Lonely Planet section. So, Paulo, you were talking about sort of that how Latin American writers have to be sort of authentic chroniclers, and so, you know, if this is like required reading for going, you know, to see Machu Picchu. I don't understand the connection at all, but you know. I do know a good hotel in Cusco, if anyone wants to. but I think the opposite problem is actually at least as interesting, because you know, I got to Peru and my book was translated, and there was a lot of interest. I thought what was interesting was the book was, there was an interest in less in the book than in me as a person. You know, why don't you don't speak Spanish with an accent, so why did you write it in English? And then, you know, when I sort of like, well, where do you come from? What is it that you do? Where did you grow up? And why, you know, who are you, basically? Like, the El Bicho Raro was a phrase that I heard a lot. And it's something that, that it's less interesting to me than talking about what the actual content of the work, but I think it's sort of just a function of, you know, they're in Mexico, people understand what a Chicano is. Even if they don't read Chicano writers, they know what Chicano means. But there's no parallel word. There's no definition of a, like, Peruano Americano. There's no such thing as a Peruvian Chicano. You know, it just doesn't exist. And so, I think I was in the fortunate position of being one of the first, and I'm sure there'll be many more Peruvian writers who write in English, who come back to Peru and are sort of accepted or become part of the conversation in their home country. And that's really exciting for me. I should say that one of the reasons that I've been part of the conversation has to do with Julio, has to do with Etiqueta Negra, and has to do with my long association with the magazine, which has been really great for me, because it allows me to write about the U.S. in Spanish, which is a lot of times much easier for me. So, for example, one of my first pieces was about the Mall of America, and for which Julio sent me to spend 2 weekends in.
I asked you to go there. I didn't send because I didn't pay the.
That's true. Well, it's funny when you said that I'll be out of a job. You know, I was really, really going to be devastating to my finances. There's a joke about the Peruvian poet who goes to claim his royalties, and they say, "Do you want heads or tails?" So it's basically my situation at Pita Negra. I remember another piece that I wrote about for another eating and drinking issue about, and I wrote about competitive eating. And I was working with Vilela at the time, and he emailed me and said, "Oh, Daniel, this is great. You know, we're a nonfiction magazine, you know," because he just didn't believe that could exist, you know. And I actually interviewed a guy who, you know, because, you know, shoving, you know, hot dogs down your throat for sport in Peru doesn't really make much sense. And the guy I interviewed actually was a student at UC Santa Cruz and was a swimmer and, you know, talked about training. And I asked him, I was like, "Is this really a sport?" He's like, "Yeah, it's totally a sport." And I had these great quotes. And yeah, my editor just didn't believe me. He said, "You know, you can't make anything up in this magazine." I think it's interesting because the outsider view is always a rich place from which to write, and so I have the benefit, I think, the good fortune to feel at home in the United States, at home in Peru, but also to have access to the what it feels like to be an outsider in both. So certainly in Peru, there's certain things that I see that I find shocking and that no Peruvians seem to notice. Right. And there's certain things in the United States that I find shocking and that, you know, most Americans seem to accept as just normal. With the novel I've been working on now for, you know, let's say 4 years or more, I've actually gotten to play with both of those points of view. Second Lives is part of that novel, and the point of view of the brother and his travels throughout the United States was particularly fun to write because basically I just went back to my childhood and revisited the places that I grew up in the United States and then imagined them through the eyes of these cousins of ours that would come visit and stay with us in Birmingham, Alabama, and always trying to imagine what the hell it must have been like to come to Birmingham, Alabama from Lima and look around with the eyes of a Peruano and you know, walk into the halls of Berry High and just, you know, what does that feel like, you know? I do remember a cousin of ours arrived, and in Peru, of course, you kiss, you know, to say hello, and he was first day introduced to a girl, a neighbor, a friend of my sister's. He kissed her on the cheek, and she turned, you know, bright red, the color of your dress, you know, and then he got this reputation, I think, for being like kind of like a atrevido, you know. And you know, he couldn't have been more of a gentleman. But there's very, very funny stories of that I've picked up over the years that I've heard of people like my cousins who came to stay with us, who have sort of arrived in America and in the United States, I should say, and have no. You know, have learned a little English in school and then are suddenly dropped in the middle of it, and it's just like, you know, sink or swim, and often a very awkward combination of the two. I remember a story of a friend of mine. He said that there was these kids, he was dropped in a big American public high school outside Houston, Peruvian kid, middle class kid, and these kids beat him up every day. They were harassing him, and one day they pushed him up against the lockers and he lost it, and he said, in Peru, you say, "Vayete la mierda." So he's like, "Go to shit, go to shit, go to shit." And that his tormentors found this so funny that they let him go and they became his kind of protectors. And every time they'd see him in the hallway, they would say, "Hey, go to shit, go to shit." It was interesting. You know, I think for me, there were a lot of sort of turning points. Some of them are literary, and some of them were not literary. In terms of feeling the freedom to write about Latin America in English and not feel like I was losing anything, and these are great. Mostly have to do with texts. And I think I should mention a couple. I think Drown, Gino Diaz's collection was really important for me, as was the fact that he was on the cover of Newsweek with Shakira. So I was like, wow, you can be a writer and be on the cover of Newsweek with Shakira. And Francisco Goldman, even I'd say more so than Juno, because Juno's stories were New Jersey, New York stories with some Santo Domingo, but Francisco writes, Long Night of White Chickens, and especially The Ordinary Seaman, a very complex, very moving novel that is written entirely in English that tells a story that's happening in Spanish and doesn't have any sort of qualms about what's sort of the choice to write it in English. So he's a writer that I think is has been really important for me, and certainly meeting him and sort of becoming friends has been a great pleasure. He's been a mentor to me and a really, really good friend. Earlier, the idea, and I don't have a timer, so I have no idea whether I'm going over or not. But I think one of the problems with the United States doesn't translate a lot, and I think 3% is the number that's usually given. On the other hand, 3% out of the gazillion books that are published here in the United States is a lot of books. The question is, what is pushed on us? And there's also the problem of I think this is a kind of a grave responsibility for writers like me, that oftentimes Americans would rather read the hyphenated American writing about their parents' country than read the writer from that country who's been translated into English, for reasons of clarity, for reasons of style, for reasons of whatever. And so I think it's kind of, great writers, American writers of Russian descent, young writers, Olga Grushin, Gary Steingart, for example, David Bismozga's Canadian, I think Lithuanian, like that, the whole fallen Soviet universe, great, great writers. But we're reading them and we're not reading, writers who should be translated from the original language. I haven't read a Russian novel since, Dostoevsky or something, and that's I think a really serious problem. In my case, I've tried to mitigate the guilt that I feel for that, or not guilt, but the kind of weight that I feel by trying to work to create certain bridges. One is through my work with Etiqueta Negra, trying to get American writers into the Peruvian dialogue. I think that's very important. And the other has been trying to open doors for publishing writers, Latin American writers in the United States. So Julio mentioned the VQR, the Virginia Quarterly Review issue in 2007. We won a National Magazine Award for that. It was a co-production between Etiqueta Negra and VQR. I co-edited along with Ted Genoways. And, it was the first time a major American literary journal, a very, very respected literary journal, had published an issue that was two-thirds of it was written originally in Spanish. The editing was a bitch. I mean, editing, pieces that were half translated so that, and then, Julio turns in 10,000 word drafts when you ask him for, 6,000 words. These kinds of things. So it was really tough, but it paid off, and it was a really great, great accomplishment. As a result of that, I was asked to do an issue of Zoetrope. It was also on Latin America writers, and got had the opportunity to read, an excuse to read a lot of my peers, and then get their work translated in English. And we did a trilingual issue, actually, because we had a story from Brazil that was published in the original Portuguese. So those are the kinds of things that I've tried to do, and sort of, whenever I can, jump at the chance to do, because it's important. I think that there are certain writers that there are certain positions that you can occupy that are a real privilege, but also have with them certain responsibilities. And I think one of the responsibilities I have is to open doors to the extent that I can. I think that I've just exhausted my 17 points. And I would really, I guess part of it is just to open it up, and I think that would be a good time to do it would be now. Thank you.